And joining us on Perspectives today is New York Times bestselling author and historian David McCullough. David is perhaps best known for his narration of the Civil War, John Adams, Truman. Well, those are just some of the things he's known for, but he's written, this is your 10th book now, David?
Yes, it is.
Wow. Congratulations, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be your guest.
Now, tell us a little bit about, first of all, because as I mentioned, you're an historian and an author, New York Times bestselling author. Have you always been interested in history?
Yes and no. I grew up with history, in effect, because my family loved to talk about the history of Pittsburgh, our hometown, and my father and grandparents could be quite engaging in recounting the stories of the floods and fires and labor strikes and the rest that Pittsburgh experienced, and family history and some of the eccentrics that had made their appearance in our family over the generations, and I loved that part of it. But and I enjoyed history in school. I had excellent history teachers. But when I got to college, I majored in English because I wanted, among other things, to be a writer. And I took a lot of art and painting and drawing because I also wanted to be an artist. And I'm very glad that I was able to do both. And it wasn't until much later, when I was in my early 30s and working with the U.S. Information Agency in Washington during the Kennedy years, that I happened on some photographs at the Library of Congress taken by a photographer who got into the territory of the Johnstown flood shortly after the breaking of the dam there and the terrible disaster that resulted. And having lived not very far away from Johnstown in Pittsburgh, I'd heard about the terrible flood much of my life, but really had no idea of the scale of the destruction and the dreadful wreckage of it all that was shown in those photographs. And I took a book out of the library to find out what happened, because I really didn't know. And it was not very satisfactory book. So I took another one out, and it supplied even less of questions I had in my mind. So I thought, well, why don't you try and write the book you'd like to read about the Johnstown flood? And that's what I did. And once I got started on the work, on the research particularly, I realized that this is something I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and I have been ever since. I signed my first contract for that book with Simon & Schuster 50 years ago this year, and I've been with Simon & Schuster ever since, and none of my books has ever been out of print.
Now, as you mentioned, you've been came out almost half a century ago, and the fact that you launched that career in 10 books, 10 successful books, you've done a lot of research, as you mentioned. Now, for the two books that won you the Pulitzer Prize, Truman and John Adams, those are big books. And anyone who's a reader will say, well, that's okay. But I've talked to people, and pardon the cliche, but they said, I just couldn't put it down. And they are fast reading.
Well, thank you. I try very hard to make what I do as engaging and readable as possible. I don't think that history should ever be made boring, but it so often is in textbooks and some of the ways in which it's taught, with stress on dates and quotations from obscure provisos and the like. And it's about people. It's about the human experience. History is human. When in the course of human events, our Declaration of Independence begins, and the operative word there is human. And so I try in my work as best I can to bring these very significant people, excuse me, from our past back into life again. And that's not as hard as it might seem. because of the letters they wrote and the diaries they kept.
And the John Adams.
In the case of John Adams,
yes,
and Truman, both, they were writing letters all the time, all their lives. And they were very revealing letters and very full of the problems and the aspirations and the humor and the melancholy that goes with life. They were very real people.
These two presidents, David, a lot of them, when people think of presidents, they'll mention Washington, Lincoln, you know, Kennedy, because of the assassination and other things that happened. But Adams and Truman are kind of left in behind the scenes, but these books brought them to the forefront. And as you mentioned, because of the letters they wrote, especially John and Abigail, they brought out the fact that these people were very human. They were married, just like any other couple, the children, family, but also they were very good friends. And Abigail was, if you want to put it that way, one of the founding mothers.
Well, she certainly was. I think she's one of the great Americans of all time. I think she's admirable in the extreme. She had her failings and faults, as everyone does. The fact that these two particular presidents are not as well known, or were not as well known as the more outstanding, taller, handsomer presidents of their days, is what drew me to them. I really believe in giving credit where credit's due, where credit's long overdue. And both Truman and Adams were preceded and followed by presidents who were taller, handsomer, more celebrated in their day. But with the passage of time, both Adams and Truman have emerged as being infinitely more important than they were given credit for. And in the case of Truman, many of us feel that he's one of the outstanding presidents ever, particularly when one takes into account all the difficult decisions and political realities he was up against. Those who belittled him or misunderstood or underestimated him. And the dust has to settle in order for all of us to see what really mattered, who really achieved something of consequence, and in a way that is not clouded by emotions or fanfare of the time, of the day. I remember the night of Truman won the 1948 election, and I couldn't stay awake. I was very interested in politics. I was in high school at the time, and I wanted to stay awake but couldn't. And so the next morning I went to, my father was in shaving, and I went and said, "Dad, who won?" I grew up in a very Republican family. He said, "Oh, Truman," like it was the end of the world. Well, 25, 30 years later, I was back home, and my father and I were talking, and he was going on about how the world was going to hell and the country was going to hell. And then he paused and he said, "Too bad old Harry isn't still in the White House." That isn't the way you saw it back when I was in high school, to say the least. But he had reappraised Harry Truman, as so many have, and Truman is finally taking the place on stage that he so deserves.
And one of the things that we remember about President Truman is the fact that, you know, the sign, the buck stops here, and the fact that he made everybody, to make them know that he was in charge. He had those decisions, and it was his decision. And so when President Kennedy was assassinated, I remember one of the interviews that they did, and they interviewed him about, you know, what was President Johnson going to do now? And he said, "Well, that's up to the president. You guys have always tried to make us tell us what's in charge and who's in charge, and that's his decision, and you guys don't need to know anything about it."
Right, that's right. He was a very brave man. It takes a lot of courage. Kennedy's famous book, Profiles in Courage, couldn't be a more apt volume in anyone's on anyone's shelf who wants to understand the American story. And courage comes in all kinds of forms, in all kinds of situations. But I think the most important and admirable courage is the courage of one's convictions, which is often quite a different matter than, say, the courage it takes to rush into a burning house to save somebody's life. And it often means facing lack of popularity, to say the least, or even outright scorn or or ridicule. And Truman could handle that. So could Adams. I apologize for my coughing, but it's I hope it's something you can edit out.
Yes, sir. We are visiting with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times bestselling author David McCullough. His latest book is The Wright Brothers, and this is his 10th book. And we're talking with David in general about some of his history, some of the books, and of course we'll touch on the Wright Brothers, but there are so many things to talk about with this great man. And one of the other presidents that you touched upon, I shouldn't say touched upon because it's another one with a lot of research, and that was Mornings on Horseback. And the title may be misleading to people who may not heard about it or read about it, but this touches on Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes, indeed. It's about his boyhood, his growing up, and the adversities he had to overcome in order to be the man he emerged to be. Mainly his struggle with his health and his fear of everything and his timidity. And he was odd. He was an odd boy. And the powerful influence of his father. I believe very strongly that more needs to be known about what might be considered the supporting characters or subsidiary characters. Theodore Roosevelt's father, the father of the Wright brothers, as you said, the role played by Abigail Adams in Adams' story. But I have to emphasize, because it's become something that I feel is of increasing importance, that history isn't just about politics and war. And while politics and war do indeed constitute a very large part of history, there's much else, and particularly much else that reflects the human heart and the human desire to achieve something of value. The part played by art and architecture and science and medicine and the advance of technology, as we're surely seeing in our own time as never before, the role of music and poetry and great fiction. That's all very important as an element in history. Often it speaks for a civilization or a generation far more eloquently and over a far larger reach of time than do the pronouncements of politicians or generals. And so I have devoted much of my working life to that side of history, and I consider my new book, on the Wright brothers, the third in a trilogy that begins with my book on the Brooklyn Bridge and then my book on the building of the Panama Canal, and concludes with this book on the advent of aviation. All three American accomplishments, all three achieved by people who took on what seemed to be something impossible to do, and did so at great risk to their reputations, but also at great risk to their lives. Many people died building the Brooklyn Bridge. Far more died building the Panama Canal. And as we know, aviation took the lives of a great many, particularly in those early pioneering days. So that in all three cases, courage is an extremely important element. And the faith that one can indeed succeed as long as one works with other people. Very little of consequence is ever accomplished alone. It's one of the clearest lessons of history. It's a joint effort. And the sooner that young people learn that, the sooner that young people learn that failure and setbacks are part of life and not something you should be defeated by right away or resort into self-pity or blaming other people. The Wright brothers were set back, were ridiculed, they crashed, they made mistakes, they found that their reasoning, their technical data was inadequate or plain wrong, and they had no money, they had no political friends in high places, they had no support from a foundation or a university. They did it on their own. And how did they do that? What kind of people were they? That's something important to know.
We're visiting with historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning, and New York Times bestselling author David McCullough. His most recent book is The Wright Brothers. Now, David, this book, I remember, first of all, The Wright Brothers, as far as books go, I remember a lot of children's books because I remember one of the first biographies I read was about the Wright brothers,
yep.
And then John Adams, and then Daniel Boone. But the Wright brothers, when you start out this book, you introduce us to a part that a lot of people don't know about, and that's them as people, brother and sister, sons, the fact that, you know, the struggles they had with their mom when she passed away, and all the accomplishments that these young men had without a high school education.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes.
But they grew up with none of the so-called advantages. They lived in a house that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone, but plenty of books. And a father who insisted that they read and read all the time and read everything, read widely. And they wound up on their own achieving what was really a fully developed liberal arts education. And I think at a time when so many young people are ignoring the liberal arts or skirting around them because they want to have a career in science or technology, that there's a lesson here, that here are these men who achieved one of the greatest technical advances, breakthroughs of all history, had no technical training until they got involved with doing it themselves. But in fact, spent much of their time reading novels and poetry and history and all the elements of a fully balanced liberal arts education.
I found it interesting when in the part of the book when you talk about how their sister Catherine talked about the fact that they loved to play with their nephews and nieces' toys until they broke, and then that was when they had fun because they wanted to know how they worked and tried to fix them.
And they fix them and make them better.
Yes.
The toy that came up out from their repairs was better than the toy that had been broken. They were ingenious and innovative, to say the least. But Wilbur, the older of the two, and the leader, the big brother, if you will, Wilbur was a genius. I don't think there's any question about that. And he had a reach of mind that was far beyond the normal. And he was the visionary. And he had the capacity to articulate what they were about in a way that is very rare. The father, again, insisted that they learn how to use the English language not just correctly but effectively. So they had wonderful vocabulary. Their letters are extraordinary, and both their business correspondence and their private correspondence. The private letters, the family correspondence, number more than 1,000. And they've all been very, thankfully, saved and kept in great order at the Library of Congress. And to read them is to get inside their lives, inside their thinking in a way that is of immeasurable value. Now, we, on the other hand, aren't going to leave anything like that. We don't write letters anymore. And nobody in public life would dare keep a diary anymore because they can be subpoenaed and used against you in court. It's a real concern. How will they know what we were like, the way we can know what the say the Wright brothers or the Adamses were like by reading their voluminous and fascinating letters.
It's going to be interesting, I guess, in the future when someone writes a book saying in one of the texts, the president replied this, et cetera, because as you mentioned, people don't write letters anymore. The letter that really stands out, and you bring it out in your book, of course, is the one that Wilbur wrote to the Smithsonian.
Yes, indeed. He sat down at the little slant-top desk that belonged to his sister in the front parlor of their house in Dayton and wrote to the Smithsonian telling him of his interest in aviation and his determination to do some experimenting, and would they please send him everything they had on the subject. And the Smithsonian did, not only sending him papers and pamphlets and published essays of all kinds, but a reading list of the books that he should undertake to read. And that was exactly what he wanted, exactly what he needed, and he proceeded ambitiously to absorb all that and succeeded at it. I don't think it can be overestimated that how hard they worked. They, as one of their great admirers on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, Kitty Hawk, commented, they were the workingest boys he'd ever seen in his life. And the people in Kitty Hawk had to work extremely hard just to survive, so they knew what hard work was. And as odd as these two fellows from Ohio may have seemed to them, because they knew, as everybody else in the world knew, that man can't fly, and they were just wasting their time. But the fact that they worked so hard had enormous appeal to the people there, and eventually they came around to believing in what these two could accomplish as much as the brothers themselves.
When Wilbur was set back because of the accident, I'm not sure it was an accident, but that bully, he was hit with a hockey stick. And when he was nursing his way back to health and also taking care of his mother, you think this was also a good period for him because it gave him an opportunity to read more? And
yes, it was a big swerve in his life, and he retreated into sort of self-imposed seclusion at home. He had been planning to, aspiring to go to Yale to get an education in college. But all that talk ended. And what he did was read intensely on his own. And what seemed to be one of the worst of all blows ever brought about a whole change in direction that was not only of infinite importance to him, but infinite importance, as it turned out, to the history of the world. And I choose as a quotation at the beginning of my book an observation that he recorded in his notes that he kept on soaring birds, the birds that he studied on the Outer Banks, the gannets and the gulls and vultures that could soar without flapping their wings, stay up in the air, just seemed to ride with the wind. And he said, no bird soars in a calm. In other words, the adversity, what seems to be the current that's running against you, it can be the current that lifts you to attain what you aspire to achieve.
We're visiting with award-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning, New York Times bestselling author David McCullough. His latest book is The Wright Brothers. And David, a lot of the pictures and I guess the stories that we hear about the Wright brothers is, of course, their first flight. But a lot of people don't realize that the first flight was actually a very short distance. And then also the accomplishments they reached were not really noticed by America until they went overseas to France.
That's right. What they achieved at Kitty Hawk in 1903 was to take off in a motor-driven flying machine with a pilot, in that case it was Orville, and to fly, as you say, a very short distance, 120 feet, in the air, no more than 12 seconds. But they did it. And before the day was over, Wilbur was flying over 500 feet, almost half a mile. And they had no doubt that they had achieved flight, but they had not achieved a practical airplane. In other words, the a plane that could bank and turn, fly in a circle, fly in a figure eight, take off, land safely. And that took them another 2 years. So it wasn't until 1905 that they developed the first practical airplane, and they did that at a test ground that they had used, a cow pasture, 8 miles out of Dayton. And in the first case where they flew at Kitty Hawk, and in the second case where they flew at Dayton, nobody took it seriously. The press wouldn't even come out and to the cow pasture to see what was going on. One of the editors of one of the Dayton papers years later was asked, well, how could that have been? How could you have ignored what was right there under your nose? And he said, I guess we were just plain dumb. of course, he was speaking the truth. They were. But it wasn't, as you say, it wasn't until the French invited them to come over and demonstrate what they could do in France that the world finally saw, and the newspapers of the world reported that man could fly. That was in 1908, first demonstration put on by Wilbur on the 8th day of August in 1908, the 8th day of the 8th month of the 8th year of the new century. And from that point on, thousands of people flooded to the flying field where these demonstrations were staged, which was at Le Mans, the city south east of Paris, where the great racetracks are. And he was one of the heroes of the world. He and his brother both became two of the best-known people on Earth, having had no desire for fame, no desire for the limelight, really wanted to avoid the limelight because it interfered with the jobs they wanted to do.
We're visiting with award-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning, New York Times bestselling author David McCullough. The latest book is The Wright Brothers. But one of the things that you mentioned also, and a lot of people think, I guess, when they read the children's books about the Wright Brothers, they associate them with a bicycle shop. One of their first bicycles, they named it after their grandmother. And the first airplane, I guess, was called the Wright Flyer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And, well, actually, I wanted to ask you if you could give us a website, because there are so many dates here, David, so many interesting things that people are going to miss out on. So what is the website that they can go to find out more about the Wright Brothers and the book?
Simon & Schuster website, yes, indeed.
And there you can find excerpts from the book. Also, the book is loaded with a lot of pictures that we have not seen before. And so, David, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you for being with us.
Well, I've greatly enjoyed it, and I appreciate very much your line of questions. It couldn't have been more enjoyable for me. Thank you.
We've been visiting with Pulitzer Prize-winning, New York Times bestselling author David McCullough. The latest book is The Wright Brothers.